The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, joins us by phone with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about real-time holograms.
Well, not quite real-time, Rob.
Tell us more about it, Dave.
Well, Rob, do you remember that scene in Star Wars, that classic sci-fi movie where Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke are gathered around R2-D2 and he beams a hologram of Princess Leia in front of them and she says, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope."
Right.
Yes?
So how close are we to that kind of capability?
Well, Rob, turns out we're a lot closer than we've ever been. You know, researchers have been creating holograms for decades, but they're very expensive to make. And the type of holograms that researchers have been able to create so far, not only are they expensive, but they're usually pretty small because the film that you need to make them on is a very expensive film. So that's really limited their utility. And obviously what researchers, the gold standard is for a researcher to develop something like we saw over three decades ago in Star Wars, where not only is it a hologram, but it's a hologram that's moving in real time.
So making the science fiction reality. Okay.
Exactly.
So the innovation here is some sort of less expensive film or what?
Exactly. What the researchers here found is they were able to devise what they call a polymer-based holographic film that's far cheaper than the current films that they're using. And they were able to also create a technology where the image on the film would update every 4 minutes. Now, that doesn't sound like very fast, and actually it's pretty slow. Can you imagine watching a movie where the frames only update every 4 minutes? That's pretty slow. So they kept on working and working on this. They created this setup where they had 16 cameras arranged in a semicircle around a target, and the cameras would film the target every second. And then they use lasers to actually create the image of the hologram, which is the typical way you actually create holograms. They basically combined all this technology, the cheap film, the cameras, the lasers, and they were able to create these close to real-time holograms that update images about every 2 seconds.
Using the same piece of film?
Yeah, it's essentially rewritable. Now, 2 seconds isn't ideal because, again, if you're watching a movie and the frames are only refreshing every 2 seconds, it's going to seem very sort of herky-jerky and not fluid. The ideal is to get it down much faster than that so these images actually look live. And the goal eventually is you would have this hologram and you could, say, project an image of a car on a table, and somebody standing at the front of the table is going to see the hood of the car, but as they walk around the table, just as if you were to walk around a real object, you would see the doors and then you would see the trunk. And you can actually see a video of this happening on the site with a hologram of a military airplane.
Besides the sort of gee whiz, wow, that's just like Star Wars impact factor here, what are researchers hoping to do with this technology?
Well, Rob, before we leave the gee whiz, one cool gee whiz application is a movie that would be a truly immersive experience. Imagine sitting in a movie theater and the action is actually surrounding you on all sides. But for the non-gee whiz applications, there's actually some very important medical applications that come out of this. Researchers have been talking for a while about creating sort of a virtual operating room where medical specialists from around the world could virtually gather around a patient and offer advice for a doctor somewhere else in the world that's conducting the surgery. So there's a lot of really practical applications for this technology in addition to the gee whiz ones.
Okay, thanks, Dave. So what other stories do you want to talk about?
Well, Rob, from people interacting with holograms to dolphins interacting with each other, this next story is about complex social networks in dolphins and how they help them reproduce.
Why are these social interactions complex, Dave?
Well, Rob, it turns out that there's several levels at which dolphins interact that makes these interactions so complex. The first level is what researchers call a first-level alliance. And this is basically when a male dolphin's out there looking for a female, he grabs one of his buddies, you can think of it like a wingman, and they both approach the female together. And the reason they need to do that is for a male to mate with a female, he has to somehow prevent the female from getting away. And so he sort of needs a buddy there to help keep the female in place while he mates with her. And females are actually a very big prize for male dolphins because they only come into estrus about every 4 to 5 years. So it's really important for a male to snag that female and keep that female once he's got her snagged. So So that's what researchers call first-level lines. That may not seem very complicated, but it gets a lot more complicated because now you've got these two males with a female, and all of a sudden some other males come along and try to steal that female away. So this first-level alliance starts to buddy up with some other first-level alliances, and then you've got what researchers call a second-level alliance, where you've basically got a much bigger group, a more complex group of male dolphins with a female sort of guarding her against other male dolphins. Now, that all sounds really complex, but it gets even more complex, and that's what this new study is about. It's about what researchers have found they're calling, believe it or not, a third-level alliance. And that's basically when these second-level alliances pair up with other second-level alliances, again, when this female is threatened. And you've got this very complex group of these male dolphins with their wingmen, those small groups paired up with other small groups, and then that agglomeration of a number of small groups then pairing up with another agglomeration of small groups to form this third-level alliance. And researchers say this is the most sophisticated networking, if you want to call it that, that's been seen in any animal besides humans. It's not even been seen in chimpanzees. And because of this, researchers speculate this may be one reason dolphins have such large brains, because they need to keep track of these really complex social interactions, these shifting alliances. Sometimes these dolphins switch sides when they're fighting over the female. So there's just a lot going on in dolphin society that we're just now starting to appreciate.
Are any of these alliances genetics, males with their brothers, say, helping out?
Well, Rob, it turns out that actually genetics doesn't really play a very big role in this. These just tend to be friendships and alliances, just like people would form friendship and alliances, not necessarily with people in your family. The dolphins are doing the same thing, sometimes with complete strangers. And that's a bit bizarre because, you know, we usually think of animals helping each other out only when they get some sort of benefit from it. And usually when it comes to enhancing one's chances of reproduction, you're really going to rely on your relatives, because even if your relatives don't end up mating, they're essentially getting some of their genes passed down to the next generation if you're a successful mater and you're related to them. But that doesn't seem to be what's happening here. The best researchers can figure is maybe these friends and strangers are pairing up with these dolphins because they expect something in return down the line. When down the line, maybe they've courted a female and need to keep her protected, you know, they'll do the dolphin equivalent of saying, hey, remember when I helped you out a few months ago or a few years ago with that female? Now I need your help. And that would, again, be a very sophisticated behavior that hasn't been seen in very many animals.
Are there alliances between females, too?
Well, there was another paper that also came out this week about alliances between females, and these alliances seem to form a somewhat different function. The researchers found that female dolphins tend to hang out with other female dolphins and as friends, but this hanging out can actually have a significant impact on the survival of their offspring. In fact, the researchers found that when female dolphins hung out with other females that had successfully raised calves, the original females had more calves that survived to age 3. And the researchers think that may happen because if you've got more females around you, they may be able to ward off sharks or other predators. And at age 3, that's when dolphins become independent. So it turns out it's not just in males that researchers have been observing these complex alliances. They've been observing alliances in females, too. And in both cases, these alliances are really important to the survival of the species.
Do they have any understanding of how the dolphins build their alliances?
No, Rob, that's still an open question, and actually that's the focus of ongoing research, is how the dolphins form these alliances, maybe something with the way they communicate. That's still a mystery at this point.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from how dolphin relationships help populate the species to how relationships between bacteria and flies help flies populate their species. Rob, this last story is about the bacteria that live in and on top of all of us. And it's not just humans. You know, we've got bacteria that live all over our skin and in our intestines. And these bacteria help us do everything from digest food to potentially ward off diseases. Well, flies have them too. And it turns out that in flies, these bacteria may even influence which individuals flies mate with.
What's bacteria got to do with that?
Well, it's a little unclear, but researchers do know that bacteria can play a role in the smells that emanate from a body. But bacteria can even play a more subtle role in the smells, or what researchers sometimes call the pheromones, the sex pheromones that animals, some animals use to determine who would make an appropriate mate. And so that was one possible mechanism. But backing up a little bit, this study really comes from a weird observation in the 1980s where researchers were working with fruit flies, and these are these tiny little flies, kind of hard to see. And what they did was they divided the flies into two groups, and they fed one group one type of diet, and they fed another group another type of diet, and they did this for many generations. And then they combined the flies back together, and what was really bizarre was that the flies would only mate with flies that had been raised on their same diet. If they encountered a fly, even if that fly was totally receptive to mating, if that fly had been raised on a different diet, the other fly wouldn't mate with him or her. And the researchers sort of scratched their head and didn't know what to make of it. So in this new study, researchers said, well, maybe bacteria have something to do with it, because bacteria might influence pheromones. And also, diet can influence the composition of bacteria in an individual, even us. If we eat different diets, we have different populations of gut bacteria.
So there's nothing about the food that the flies ate that made them somehow less fit?
No, and the way the researchers showed that was they took these flies, they repeated this classic experiment where they took a population of flies, split in two, and fed one population a diet of molasses and cornmeal, and another one a diet of starch. And for many generations, these flies were eating very different diets. And when they recombined them, just as the other researchers had shown, the flies would only mate with flies that had eaten the same diet. But to get to your question, Rob, the question was, well, is it really the bacteria that's causing this and not the food? And what they did was they repeated the experiment again, but this time they treated the flies with antibiotics to kill all the bacteria. And all of a sudden, that weird effect went away. The flies would basically mate with whoever was receptive, and it didn't matter who they encountered and or what the diet was of the fly that they encountered. And so that was a strong indication that it was the bacteria and not another factor that was really influencing these mating decisions.
So the antibiotics cut down on the bacteria, that cut down on the smell and or changed the pheromones of the flies.
Exactly. And in fact, researchers measured pheromone levels and they saw that treatment with antibiotics actually reduced the difference in the various amounts of pheromones between flies that had eaten different diets. So it sort of leveled off those pheromones. And so smell-wise, these flies didn't appear any different to each other, even though they had eaten different diets when they were treated with antibiotics.
Is this kind of thing likely to happen in the wild when all fruit flies are likely to have access to the same foods?
Well, researchers aren't sure, but related to that, the really intriguing angle is that by causing these flies to selectively mate with other flies, these bacteria could even be causing the creation of new species. One way new species form is if individuals in a single population start mating selectively with other individuals in that population. And after many, many generations, when you have certain types of individuals that are only mating with other types of individuals within a population, those individuals start to become their own species. They develop traits that distinguish them from their brethren. And the researchers say something very similar could be happening in the wild. Even if it's not happening with fruit flies, it could be happening with other organisms, and bacteria could be a possible mechanism.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about a new potential therapy for strokes, and also a story about how electrically stimulating the brain could improve somebody's math skills. And on Science Insider Science's policy blog, we've got very comprehensive coverage of the midterm elections that just took place in the U.S., what the impact is going to be on science, on things like funding for NIH, and on issues like climate change and stem cell research. There may be many changes ahead with this new political landscape, and you can read all about this and the Science Now stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.